appear in the highly popular literary diary genre of the time. The public wish for photographs of the Silk Road was large and various companies came into being to satisfy this demand. For example, Underwood and Underwood were a distributor of photographic images. They would create box sets with accompanying commentary on particular themes for the public to buy and view in the comfort of their own homes. It was a popular after-dinner party practice to invite guests to come and view such sets of photographs and gaze in awe, and often with superiority, at distant and exotic lands and people. Some sets even advertised how such viewings were better than actually going to the places pictured, as you did not have to deal with the natives. These companies also sold box sets to magic lantern theatres. These theatres were hugely popular with the general public during the late 19th and early 20th century, and the showing of projected photographs would be accompanied by music and oratory about the subject being shown. Photographic companies also sold their images to magazines. One of the most long-lived magazines that published Silk Road photographs was the National Geographic. However, they tended to send out their own photographers and correspondents into the field rather than purchase images from outside sources, though they did sometimes do that. The National Geographic did not only use their photographic archive for illustrating their magazines, but also distributed educational material illustrated with their photographs to schools. One might say that they shaped young minds with their vision of what the world was like and how it should be represented both visually and in writing. One of the most famous documents of exploration of the Silk Road was produced with the help of the National Geographic through their correspondent Dr. Maynard Owen Williams during the Citroën Hart Transasiatic Expedition, which took place from 1931 to 1932. This expedition was advertised as being a science-based expedition that retraced the route taken by Marco Polo. However, it seems that it also had a strong commercial purpose. Silk Road photography seems to have been used here to advertise the prowess of Citroën motor vehicles to Europeans and Americans to attract more European subscribers to the National Geographic. Little scientific work resulted from the expedition, though many impressive and evocative photographs of the Silk Road and of the might of the Citroën vehicles on the Silk Road were produced and published. There were also those persons who were simply adventurers, such as John Thompson or Heinz von Perkhammer. They would take photographs during their self-funded travels and then publish them in their own books. In the case of John Thompson, his publications had a strong socialist purpose, whilst Heinz von Perkhammer's had an erotic and artistic purpose. Maynard Owen Williams, like many people in the Western world during this period, was a devout Christian. Indeed, some of the earliest European explorers of the Silk Road were motivated by their faith. There were numerous Christian missions being set up and run in the lands of the Silk Road during the late 19th and early 20th century, and they all needed funding. Some of these missions utilised photography as a means to generate those funds. There were even newspapers such as the New York Christian Herald that were dedicated to the work of Christians throughout the world, whose stories were accompanied by photographs. Even magazines that did not profess to be religious in aim produced articles that reported on Christianity along the Silk Road. Such images of the lands of the Silk Road that had a religious lilt tended to depict poverty-stricken children, the backwardness and opium addiction of the non-Christian people, or the good that the church had done for the community they were located in. Other images that were influenced by Christianity were those taken of the Near East, in which there exists many sites deemed holy by Christians. These gave the public images of the places they had only read about in the Bible and constitute some of the earliest photographic images of the Silk Road. Despite the diversity of purpose amongst the early Silk Road photographers, many of them do have commonalities. For example, most came from upper middle class or upper class backgrounds, and due to the smallness of the community, most knew or at least had heard of each other. For example, Maynard Owen Williams and Heinz von Perkhammer. Williams wrote to the National Geographic in 1932 urging them to make sure that they had copies of Perkhammer's work in their library as he considered his work to be so fine. And as one would expect, there were also bitter rivalries and disputes between photographers, like those between Sven Hedden and Oriel Stein. Other commonalities were that many of the photographers did not embark upon their profession or travel the Silk Road simply because of Baron Ferdinand's writing. A number cite historical figures of fact and fiction as their inspiration, for example, Marco Polo, Alexander the Great, or Zhang He. Whilst others refer to their love of the great Orientalist works of the pre-Raphaelite and Romantic era painters and writers, for example, Maynard Owen Williams regularly writes in his diaries of his great passion for going to the theatre to see performances by the likes of the Ballet Russe. This leads one to suppose that these works might have been an early factor in the photographer's choice of profession, views towards, and their presentation of their subjects. A significant number of these Silk Road photographers' work fit seamlessly into the canon of Orientalist art and literature that came before them. For example, the similarities between the work of artists like Jean Jerome and those images taken in the bazaar in Afghanistan, in a bazaar in Afghanistan in 1931 by Maynard Owen Williams, is rather striking. One must therefore question how true to life early Silk Road photography was when so many of the photographers seem to have been drawn to their profession by romantic fantasies of the East. Is it possible that some of these photographers these photographs were constructed to fit the Western public's notion of the East and Silk Road? The answer would be yes, surely some were. If the photographer was using an early form of colour photography, such as autochrome or other slow-reacting technology, the only way to get a clear image was to choose your subject and then ask them to hold still whilst you expose the plate or film. There would have been no other way to get the shot otherwise. This raises questions regarding how and what poses were decided upon for the subject. In the case of commercial images, those photographs destined for adverts, magazines, or for general sale, one expects that the photographers might have orchestrated a particular shot in order to appeal to their Western audience's taste and preconceptions. However, if one was photographing a member of government or other powerful individual, the subject might well have had more of a say over the photograph's construction. Most of the Silk Road photographs do not seem to challenge any pre-existing stereotype concepts of the East. I have come across various accounts in which photographers for publications like the National Geographic deliberately chose not to photograph any modernity in the parts of the Silk Road they visited, or complained that they could not find subjects that would conform to the Western public's ideas of what the Silk Road or East Asian person was. It was not only in commercial photographs that pressures would have been felt to produce a particular image. Manipulation of shots may have occurred in those government-funded scientific photographs. Those photographers may have felt pressure to produce evidence that supported the prerogative of the expedition's funding body. The contents of these photographs may well have affected the viewers' conceptions of the Silk Road in Asia, but the way in which these photographs were presented to the viewer also had an impact. It was common for these images to be used alongside highly Orientalist writing and commentary. Later photographers from the turn of the century might have been influenced by or influenced the photography found in cinema and theatre. For example, Indiana Jones is said to have been modelled on these photographer explorers, and Maynard Owen Williams was contacted by Paramount Pictures in regards to finding locations for the filming of Samson and Delilah in 1949. Williams's influence even reached the fashion world, with Parisian designers like Schiaparelli taking direct inspiration for one of her collections from his work for the Citroën Heart expedition. In conclusion, I believe that these photographs are in need of further study, particularly in regards to the impact they have had on Western visualization of the Silk Road and the impact that has had on our ideas of East Asia as a whole. Many of these photographs are undeniably beautiful images and have captured moments of what some might call reality from a way of life that for many no longer exists. However, one must also be aware that there are many issues that surround their creation that need to be recognised and thought in depth about. I believe that studying this genre of photography further might help the West to reflect on the relationship it has cultivated with the Silk Road in Asia during a key point in the Silk Road's and the East's regeneration and rise to prominence and dominance on the world stage. In my view, early Silk Road photography is an interdisciplinary subject whose study should not be confined to the field of art history, but would be best served by academics from across different fields. I am therefore very interested to hear any thoughts or try to answer any questions you might have on the topic. And I would like to thank you all for coming and the Sagur Centre for supporting me in my research and allowing me to give this presentation today. Thank you. I'm sorry if I spoke ever so fast, but I was very concerned about the time. So.
Fantastic, Maeve. Well, I think we've probably got an opportunity for a healthy discussion. So if you have any questions or comments for me, the only request is to please identify yourself.
Oh, I'm Jill Gottlieb. I'm just wondering if you may have had the opportunity to travel to some of these regions yourself.
Yeah.
What have your experiences been?
I used to live in Beijing, and for a little bit in southern China in Yunnan province, and then I visited around and about China and also some places in Xinjiang and things. And when you say what I think, how do you mean, like,
what your experiences were
when I was in those places?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was in Beijing, I was a ballet dancer, so my I mean, I was training, like, professionally as a ballet dancer, so my experience there was of being a lot of sweat and then I'm working and but yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, really, and extraordinarily diverse everywhere. Even within Beijing, if you go to different places, it's, you know, not one place is the same as the other. And I think some of the images that appear in these photographs, I would say that I've, like, come across, I think. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what more to say in terms of my, yeah.
I am Bob. I'm here too. But are there any collections by either Chinese photographers in the early 20th century or Japanese photographers? And have you been able to look at how they get if they're replicating this framing of?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was a period of in port cities in China. There was What was the name for it? I've forgotten the name. It was actually in India as well. Originally it started in painting and then it went into photography, but it was taking photographs for tourists that came. So it would photograph kind of ethnic types, was the popular phrase then, of people doing various skill work and things like that. And those definitely conformed to the tastes of Europe, but and that appeared in the photography later. So I don't. Yeah, I'd say there is some cross. And also, there are lots of there's the father of Uzbek photography, who I won't even try to pronounce the name of because it'll be awful if I do. Who took lots of photographs and things, and a lot of them kind of. Seems similar to the European photographer's work as well. But also, I mean,
because in Taiwan you see this remarkable explosion of Japanese ethnography of Taiwan, quote unquote, natives.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if during the Japanese sort of intrusion into China, you found something similar.
Well, I mean, I haven't been able to study so much the photographers from the countries that, or areas that the Silk Road photographers went to, just because, I mean, it's such a vast subject, and I have to kind of rein it in a bit. But I know that there was a lot of influence on photography in China and India and from Europeans, but I don't know about the Japanese side coming in. But I'm sure, I mean, everybody influences everything with everyone, so, and then people will, you know, depending on who their photographs are meant to appeal to, they'll deliberately kind of, you know, just so as you can sell things, really. But then I'm sure that people also bought in influences from artistic cultures from their own area as well. to their depiction. Yeah. But I would be interested in the future to do a comparison between the way in which European photographers and photographers from the places they visited depicted the same kind of things going on. Yeah.
What was your initial draw to doing this? This was your dissertation.
My PhD.
PhD. Yeah. Right. So. Yeah, was it the Silk Road in and of itself and the cultural thing, or the photography, or both, or did you walk into this moment, the wow moment, this is what I wanted to do it on?
Well, I mean, when I was at ballet school, there was a big room where they kept all of the costumes, and the school that I went to it also was a place where the dancers of different peoples from around China were documented, and those records were kept and then were taught to people who came to the school. And so their cupboard of clothing was very, very diverse, all kinds of things. And I always thought, oh, but you know, that looks similar to things that I've seen elsewhere, and da da da. And then I started thinking about how all of those different influences came together, and then, like, you know, came across Silk Road writing, and then when I was at university, I never concentrated on one specific area. I always looked at all different parts of the world and their interaction. And then I visited Central Asia with my father, and a huge amount of talk of Silk Road there. And then I was on a plane coming back from Kazakhstan, and there was a, in the back of the, so I already had an interest in Silk Road and the coming together of different cultures interweaving into one another culturally. And then in the back of the plane seat was one of those like plane magazines from Kazakh Airways. And I opened it, and it was like, father of Uzbek photography. And it had all of these photographs. Yeah. And I was like, wow, this has been photographed. This is amazing. And then I started looking into it. And that's kind of, it all spiraled from that cupboard and from that magazine in a plane. So,
yeah. And I take it doesn't escape you that in light of, since the breakup of the Soviet Union and the West, oil companies going in to many of these former Soviet satellite countries, and more of that emphasis of this so-called new money heading out there. Mm. And if you, in your own, you know, through the course of finishing up your dissertation, putting the past, you know, the continuum of past to the here and now.
Yeah.
The West's influence there.
I'm a bit confuddled. Sorry if I...
Well, as you're going through, you know, doing your paper and seeing all of this, do you have fleeting moments or big, huge moments like, wow, look what where the West is back in there?
Oh, yeah.
Continue to be in there, I mean, at the level, I mean, in one way or the other, ever since the fall of the Soviet Union and the West business people were able to go in there.
Yeah, for sure, I think.
And where it's all taking.
Yeah, I mean, and also if you look back at the Russian photographers at this time, I don't know if that's like a whole other subject to go down.
It's interesting. I always wanted to visit China. Like when I was young, it was like something authentic, you know, so attractive. And my first visit to China was in 2002. And there was less authenticity or...
Right.
It is so westernized.
Yeah.
I always wanted to visit it's Guangzhou. It's southern Canton province, which was basically the first point from that. This is the place where Silk Road started.
Mm. But
this is so westernized today. I mean,
you mean modern?
Yeah, it's too modern. It looks like more.
That's the story of China now.
Yeah.
But places move forward. Like you can't keep places in a.
Yeah.
You know that it's a bit like what these. I mean, these some of these photographers they would complain.
They can't hear you.
Sorry, some of these photographers, they complain about what you talk about. But like, you know, are you meant to keep somewhere as some kind? Like, you can't kind of keep somewhere as your kind of idol. Do you know what I mean? Like, places change and they move forward, and they and you. I don't think it's kind of fair to necessarily critique it.
I'm also based here, and just pick up on this, there is a kind of, in Chinese pop culture today, there's a genre called the old photographs, and then their books are published just like one after another, all these old photographs, and I think that partly answers this yearning for this disappeared old landscape buildings. And in some cases, they serve as a basis for reconstructing some of the temples, and it's not authentic in the sense that it's not the original, but I think the public, because of this hyper economic development, misses some of that.
But what is authentic? Like, authentic can start at any point, and I think these photographs perpetuate the idea that this is the authentic and the now is the inauthentic. But it's just that the now is the authentic for the people today. Yeah. Like, I think
it's
But now they're trying to rebuild a temple.
Yeah.
So maybe 50 years down, it look more authentic than it is now. But people know today that it's not the original copy. So
there's the photograph.
That's true.
People go to Munich, for instance, and they see the beautiful Marienplatz, the gorgeous buildings, and think maybe those are from the Middle Ages. No, not at all. You know, 150 years ago, it was this yearning for the past, that swept through not just Europe, but many other places, and they reconstructed things to make them look older.
But like the reconstruction thing is, this.
Yeah.
This is no longer here. So to have,
I think it might be a little more nuanced, just to follow up. I'm sorry, I don't know your name, with what you had said. I mean, first of all, before I go on that main point, I just had another thought. As far as the parallel to back then and now at this record speed of, it was oil for this, it's other kinds of commercial endeavors, but the angst of the era that we're in, primarily in the Western world, but I think, even Asia and whatnot, is the speed of change, perhaps not seen by humankind since the British Industrial Revolution. And that, and I think, to bring it to the here and now, at least in Americans, Britain and other countries, that kind of longing for an idealized, more settled, more psychologically, consciously or unconsciously, time. And hence, anyone that gives me, as a politician, strict rules, regulations, healthy boundaries of all or